people were trying to get out. And as the people were trying to get out, they were beating people up with billy clubs, you know, as hard as they could. And you could hear the whack.
That's Jane Brotman in the PBS documentary 2 Days in October. She was a UW-Madison freshman in 1967. She witnessed the Dow Chemical protest spiraling out of control on campus. Students converged on the UW Commerce Building 50 years ago today as it erupted in violence. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're remembering the Dow riot with David Moranis, an associate editor at The Washington Post. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner, author of 7 books, including They Marched Into Sunlight, War and Peace, Vietnam and America, 1967. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kate.
Let's start with the scene that Jane Brotman just described 50 years ago today on campus, UW. Describe this day. Help us get the scene in our minds.
October 18th, 1967. For a few weeks before that, as school was starting, leaders of the anti-war movement on the Wisconsin campus noticed in the paper a placement ad for Dow Chemical Company, which was coming to recruit students to work for that company. Dow Chemical Company at that point was a symbol of the depravity of the war in Vietnam. It was the makers of napalm, which was shown on television burning villages and maiming people, and of Agent Orange, which at that point wasn't quite, all of the effects of Agent Orange weren't completely known, the devastating effects over many decades, but nonetheless, it was a defoliant. And so the leaders of the anti-war movement on the campus decided that they would stage a peaceful sit-in obstructing the recruitment of students by Dow Chemical Company. And the interviews were being held in the Commerce Building, which is now has a different name, Ingram, I think, across from the Bell Tower. And so they sat in on the first floor, and that's when everything broke loose.
And they were shoulder to shoulder. They were jammed in there.
Anyone who's been in that building knows how narrow the hallways are and low the ceilings are, and it was completely full, yes, shoulder to shoulder from one side to the other.
And so then what happens? They're jammed in there. You can't get anyone in or out.
Well, many things happened, but the key thing that occurred was that the Madison Police Force was called to the scene, and many of those cops in the Madison Police Force truly despised the students of that era, the long-haired hippies, they called them, who were protesting the war in Vietnam. Many of these police officers came from working-class families who either they themselves had fought in Korea or Vietnam, or they had brothers or friends who had. And so they had there was no love lost between those police officers and the students protesting. So the first mistake was to have those officers come on the campus. It was really the first time that had happened. And a series of events occurred that led to basically a police riot inside that building.
And so behind the scenes, we're learning that Chancellor William Sewell, to keep the students in check, he had been the ones to call in Madison police. Tell us a little bit about the thinking with Chancellor Sewell.
You know, it's hard completely to understand why he did that, but you have to understand William Sewell as a somewhat tragic figure who was naive and really over his head in dealing with that situation. Bill Sewell was a terrific sociologist. He was against the war himself. He had helped set up the first peace teach-in at the campus. He believed in what he would call sort of the following the rules, and he was inexperienced at dealing with this type of protest. He was naive about it. And so partly because of pressure from the other administrators, partly because of pressure from the other side of State Street, the Capitol, and the tensions that were already building between a somewhat conservative legislature and the UW administration. He basically panicked and called in the Madison police, not really, I would say, realizing what would occur after that.
In the documentary, 2 Days in October, you recall interviewing Chancellor Sewell 35 years after Dow Day, and you said he was still visibly grieved by what had happened. There was, you said, a tragic quality to him in your description.
You know, even then, when he was recalling those events, he started to crack up. To cry. He realized what a fatal mistake he had made. And there's also a scene in my book where that night he went home and realized that this is what he would be remembered for the rest of his life, no matter what he did.
We're talking about the Dow riot on the UW-Madison campus 50 years ago today with David Moranis. He's an associate editor at the Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize winner, author of 7 books, including They Marched Into Sunlight, War and Peace, Vietnam and America, 1967. Do you remember the Dow chemical riot in 1967? Where were you? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Post your remembrance on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, prior to this day in 1967, what had the anti-war movement been like at UW-Madison?
Well, it was intense, but not broad. It was deep, but not wide. There were probably a few hundred students who were actively participating in the movement. Many of them were graduate students who had also been part of the civil rights movement. The two sort of transitioned one to the next. They were knowledgeable about what was going on in Vietnam, but it's important to remember that in the fall of 1960s, people think of the 1960s as the counterculture decade. In the fall of 1967, the largest group on the University of Wisconsin campus was the Young Republicans. Hmm. So there was, you know, the 60s really sort of started to begin, in a sense, after Dow, through the Nixon impeachment, I would say. That's really the era that people think of when they think of the 60s. So it was, you know, but 1967, that fall, was right after the Summer of Love in San Francisco. So that counterculture sensibility was starting to take hold in a larger sense and wash into more than just a few hundred committed, knowledgeable anti-war leaders. But everything changed with Dow.
And these students and graduate students had come from all over the country and world and perhaps were exercising their political voice for the first time in confrontation with Madison police?
Well, in confrontation first with the university administration.
Yeah, okay.
They really never had a conversation with the police. That conversation was basically billy clubs. The University of Wisconsin had been attracting students from all over the country for generations. That sort of started in the 1920s when many East Coast Jewish students were kept out of the Ivy League by quotas, and they started coming to the University of Michigan and the University of Wisconsin in particular. And then over the generations, that trend continued. So there are many, many out-of-state students from the East Coast at Wisconsin.
What was the relationship like between the student activists and the administration?
It was uneven, often tense. Most of these leaders were well known to the administration. Some of them were considered pains and some were considered not. It depended on their own personalities and characteristics. But generally speaking, since an earlier demonstration against Dow the previous spring, the tensions had been rising.
The violence of the Dow Chemical protest is credited with politicizing thousands of students who up to that point had been apathetic about the Vietnam War. Can you describe for us what was happening at this point in Vietnam?
Oh, it was the fall of 1967 was the beginning of a turning point. There were several hundred thousand American soldiers in Vietnam. About 12,000 had already been killed. The American presence in Vietnam went back many years, but the official arrival of American troops on the ground began in 1965, full bore war. So it had been going on for 2 years by that point, more than 2 years. And the belief by the leadership of the generals in Vietnam, led by General Westmoreland, was that they could win this war simply by battles of attrition. The more men they had, the more Vietnamese they killed, the better they would perform. And so Westmoreland was asking for even more troops from President Lyndon Johnson at that point. And the battles were not particularly going well. There was one battle the day before that I write about in my book where a battalion of the 1st Infantry Division, the Black Lions, walked into an ambush and 60 men were killed and 60 wounded. The government lied about it, which was commonplace in that era. They would make up body counts to present every battle as a victory. And Westmoreland in particular wanted to do that because he wanted to show that they were winning the war. Ironically or tragically, at that very time when the soldiers of the Black Lions were marching to their deaths, a day before the Dow demonstration on campus, President Johnson turned to the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, and uttered the chilling words, "How are we ever going to win this war?" Mm-hmm. They already knew they weren't going to win it.
And that really was at the crux then of this turning point with the Dow Day, the Dow Chemical Riot.
The Dow demonstration, the Dow Riot, was the first demonstration on a American campus that turned violent because of a police riot, and it started a wave of protests across the country. Actually, they'd begun a little bit before that on the West Coast, at San Francisco, at the recruiting station in Oakland, and a few other places. But this was the first campus protest, and then there was a wave of protests against Dow and against the government from then on.
50 years ago today, the Dow Riot helped transform the Madison campus into one of the nation's leading anti-war communities. We're remembering this with David Moranis, a graduate of the UW. He's an associate editor for the Washington Post. He wrote, "They marched into sunlight," which this protest is the centerpiece of his book on the Vietnam War. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Were you there at the Dow Riot? What do you remember? 800-642-1234. You can post your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back after a short break with more reflections on the Ideas Network.
To go in and clear the building. And they didn't say how, they just said, "We want them removed." And we said, "Fine."
The recollection of Keith Hackett, who was among the Madison police officers who confronted the Dow protesters in UW Commerce Hall building 50 years ago today. He's part of the Peabody Award-winning American Experience film 2 days in October. And we're taking your reflections at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David Marinus stays with us. Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. What I remember, because I was at the very perimeter of what was happening. I'm 73 years old now. Is the motivation for this whole thing was basically, I think it's an A. Philip Randolph quote, make war unprofitable and you make war impossible. And it was a brilliant idea, and it galvanized me. I wasn't drafted until 68. I was a conscious CO. I had a fight because of my Roman Catholic background with my Oneida County Selective Service System board, and I remember the head of the board saying to me, Mr., followed by my name, we've never had a young man who didn't want to serve his country before. And I said, I want to serve my country, but after me, you're not going to be able to say that anymore.
Hmm. David.
Well, the A. Philip Randolph quote is very profound and sadly has never come true. Every war someone has profited from, and that continues to today.
Let's take another call here at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Steve in Green Bay. Go ahead, Steve in Green Bay.
Hello. In that on this day, that was my first semester at Madison. I'm from a rural area, and everything going to school at the UW.
Oh, and we just lost Steve. Oh, goodness. I hope he calls back with that reflection, and he was right there. Let's go to Mike Nall in Holman. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was a senior at the University of Wisconsin and an observer of the Dow protests. I was standing up by Bascom Hall, and came from a small rural town, conservative. My father fought in World War II. All my friends' fathers fought in World War II. So at that time, I was pretty much a supporter of whatever the government said. But all of a sudden, the tear gas went off. I turned around to run, and I couldn't run because there were about 10 people behind me. And I subsequently, the following year, was drafted or was enlisted in the Army. And so I served in Vietnam, and there is where I learned how terrible the war was. I mean, how wrong we were.
And when I we're having trouble here. Let's go ahead, David.
Yeah, that's a very moving remembrance. I too was a freshman on the campus that fall, wearing my first blue jean jacket and experiencing tear gas for the first time. One of the reasons I wrote this book the way I did, juxtaposing that protest with the war itself in a battle, was precisely to make the point that Mike was making. You know, you can protest something, but until you see it firsthand, vividly, the horror of it doesn't quite come home in the same way. So I wanted to bring those two together. And Mike and many other young men of that era lived both of those experiences.
And some people who saw the images coming back from Vietnam, it changed the course of their life. It changed them forever. Do we still see remnants of that today in our society?
Well, I think that you see remnants of what happened in the 60s in our society today, definitely. The whole baby boom generation had a very a profound effect on American life, for better in many ways and for worse in a few ways. But yeah, I think that still definitely lives on and has shaped the thinking of so many people of my generation.
Well, Mike, thank you for calling in with that reflection. Let's bring in Bob Gruenberg now. He's a retired lawyer and now lives in Hustaford, Wisconsin. In the fall of 1967, he was a sophomore transfer student at UW-Madison, and he got caught up in the melee. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So how was it that you ended up outside Commerce Building that day?
Well, it was pure happenstance. I was between classes. I was walking my 10-speed bicycle, and the crowd was basically preventing me from getting through it. I was aware of the protest, but I wasn't at all involved. But I was ended up being fairly close and stopped and watched at the precise moment when the police basically charged into the crowd and then subsequently launched tear gas grenades or canisters, one of which landed literally in the spokes of my bicycle. So,
What was going through your mind as you saw this in front of you?
Well, I was certainly aware of the war and against it. I was not actively involved, so a lot of things started happening. I was angry that suddenly I was assumed or made part of the protest, and I just was, you know, why am I getting hit with a tear gas canister? Why are people who were, I think, a lot of whom were just observing being attacked by the police. You know, there was a lot going on in my mind at that time.
And you had this moment, as we saw in the documentary, that you said that watching the tear gas and watching the beating of protesters was like, quote, having a fire lit under you. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, it was just one of those moments in your life where you realize that things may happen that not everybody understands. I mean, you know, suddenly people, even I've read some of the other comments by people who were involved, seemingly assuming that all of those people there were involved in the protest. They weren't. You know, it was a sense of injustice, a sense of wrongness that kind of stuck with me basically through my whole career, probably led me to go to law school.
David Marinus, was it a pivotal point for you? You were a freshman in 1967. What impact did it have on your trajectory?
I have to be honest about that. I grew up in a fairly political family. My father was the city editor then of the Capital Times, which had been against the war since its inception. So the effect it had on me really was one more as an observer. I watched everything unfold from the edge of the crowd, and it stuck with me in a very powerful way, so that 35 years later I would write about that event as a way of trying to capture the Vietnam War. But I would say that Bob's experience parallels eerily the experience of one of the characters in my book, Jane Brotman, who you quoted at the beginning describing the clubs. She was on her way to a French class preparing for an exam and was not even against the war at that point, thought that, you know, the establishment should be respected. And her transformation was dramatic. She wrote a letter back to her parents after that saying she'd started to study the Vietnam War, had very serious questions about it, did not like what the police did that day, and it really awakened her. And I think in various ways, whether it was like Bob, who was against the war but really not as deeply committed to that way of thinking as he might have been, or as he was later, to someone like Jane Brotman, who had a complete transformation, I think it affected thousands of students on the Madison campus. And in various ways, events like that transformed millions of young people around the nation.
Let's take another call now. Pamela is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Pamela. What do you remember that day?
Well, I was in the committee to end the war in Vietnam, and I was protesting, and I had a class near there, and it was getting very violent, and so we ran in one of the buildings, and it was we were being chased, and we had to jump out a first-floor window and run away to keep from being beaten. And I continued to protest the Vietnam War all through my freshman year at UW. And I'm still protesting wars. You know, the United States is bombing in seven countries and intervening militarily in many more. And I still am with Peace Action Wisconsin and trying to end war 50 years later.
And Bob Gruenberg, I want to bring you in here. You're a retired U.S. attorney. How did this moment impact your values, perhaps impact your career trajectory?
Well, similar to the recent speaker, I did get much more involved in a number of protests, ended up breathing a lot more tear gas in the next couple of years. but it's just one of those things that stuck with me. I think it was a sense of justice or a sense of injustice that led me to, one, go to law school, and then to... You know, it seems kind of crazy to then become an assistant U.S. attorney, but I felt that was a, you know, it always stuck with me, and I ended up being involved in a number of cases where, you know, I think I was, you know, looking more for justice than I was for just winning a case, and I think that was all part of it.
Pamela, thank you for calling in with that remembrance. Let's go to Elizabeth now in Madison. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I was born in Madison in 1974 to conservative parents who had a store on State Street during the riots and had their windows broken and everything. And the aftermath of Dow and Sterling Hall were in the air for at least 10, 15 years after. And I really loved your book, David, because it made so many things make sense growing up in Madison in the 70s and 80s and early 90s. And I think the kind of the fallout created a generation of kids that were much more active and much more politically aware. And I was down on State Street marching by the time I was in eighth grade. So thank you for helping me understand what happened, because I was definitely very, very affected by it, even though I wasn't directly there at the time.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth. She mentioned the Sterling Hall bombing.
Yeah.
That happened in August of 1970. And a researcher, a physics researcher, was killed in that bombing, which was perpetrated by four young anti-war activists, and really was another turning point in the Vietnam War, and particularly in terms of protests, and was basically sort of the other bookend from the Dow protest, and things diminished from there for a lot of different reasons, not just the bombing, but also because the draft ended, there was a lottery. Every movement is a combination of idealism and self-interest. Mm. And when the draft ended, when the draft was on, those two had a combustible combination, because every young man, every girlfriend, mother, father was talking about what will we do? You know, will you go to Canada? Will you go to prison? Will you try to join ROTC? Will you go to Vietnam? How will you protest if you don't believe in it? And that discussion diminished when that question was no longer needed to be answered. The reason I chose 1967, and the reason I think that Dow is much more important than as a illuminating history than the 1970 bombing, is because everything was decided by 1970. 67 was before the Tet Offensive, before the country turned against the war in a profound way. By 1970, it was hideous and stale and already decided. Unfortunately, it lasted for another few years. Dow happened, there were 12,000 deaths in Vietnam on its way to 65,000. Mm. But it was, everything was up in the air in 1967. You didn't know how the war would go. You didn't know how the anti-war movement would go. It was all sort of being decided at that point.
So between 67 and 70, what was the tenor like on campus at UW-Madison?
There was a protest every semester. I know because I was there. So there were strikes. There was a TA strike. There was a strike against a bus lane. There was a black student studies strike. It was one protest after another. At one point, the National Guard was called onto the campus after the Kent State shootings, the protests because of that. So it was a very tumultuous, interesting, difficult time.
Bob Gruenberg, during this time after the Dow Chemical riot, did you start finding yourself getting involved and being more politically active? Did you find your voice?
Well, now that David mentioned all those things, I specifically remember being involved in every single one of them. There were almost continuous protests, and there was the disruption of classes. It's particularly, I remember the protest after, I was so angry after the Kent State, because we had had the National Guard with their 50 caliber machine guns mounted on the back of Jeeps, and to think that, you know, at Kent State, there were people killed, it obviously could have happened at the University of Wisconsin, where the protests were much bigger and much more active, I think, than they were there. So, yeah, I was involved in all of that. In fact, I was on on the campus the morning after the bombing at Science Hall, which was in August, but I happened to have a job, so I was on my way to the job on campus.
And what was the scene around you there?
It was eerie.
I
think what David just said about it being a bookend captures it perfectly. That's exactly it. It was a point where you started rethinking everything and how much you should be involved. And I remember the Daily Cardinal, the student newspaper, came out with an editorial in favor of it, which I was angry about that. But all of these things made you think about where you were going, and I think in particular the fact that it led to inevitably, well, the protest didn't, but we had the draft, and I was involved in the lottery, and luckily I had barely a high enough number that I didn't get drafted. I never had to make that decision about where I would, you know, my life might have changed entirely because I wasn't going to Vietnam. By that point.
We're remembering the Dow riot today. 50 years ago today, hundreds of students were protesting recruiters from Dow Chemical who were on campus at UW-Madison. Dow was the U.S. military's source for napalm. The students blocked access to the Commerce Building, and Madison police removed them by force. Dozens of students were beaten bloody. Tear gas was used for the first time in any anti-war demonstration. Our guests are Washington Post Associate Editor David Marinus, author of They Marched Into Sunlight, and we have with us retired U.S. Attorney Bob Gruenberg, who got caught up in the violence on that day as a freshman at UW-Madison in 1967. We're gathering your thoughts right now at 800-642-1234. Were you there at the Dow riot? What do you remember? What do you remember of the UW-Madison campus during this era of the Vietnam War? You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back in just a moment.
A new sound emerged out of the commotion. It sounded like somebody breaking watermelons with a baseball bat. That was pretty frightening because we were trapped and this sound was approaching.
Another voice from the PBS documentary, 2 days in October, that was James Rowan, a student protester who was inside Commerce Hall during the Dow riot. It was 50 years ago today that an anti-war protest turned violent on the UW-Madison campus as students tried to stop Dow Chemical from recruiting on campus. David Marinus stays with us. He's a Washington Post associate editor, author of 7 books, including They Marched Into Sunlight, which zooms in on the Dow riot. And we have with us retired U.S. attorney Bob Gruenberg. He got caught up in the violence that day. You can join in with your questions, your recollections, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Matt in Racine. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I graduated from Madison in 91, and around 1989 to 90, I worked at the Armory, and I was an attendant there because they had a workout room and gymnastics teams used the second floor. But to the right of where my little station was, there was a locker room, and I was told to never go in there, even though I had keys, and the floor had been knocked down, and all the green locker bays were still had fallen down into what was the basement. And I guess above that, there had been extensive repairs to the running track that circled the second floor gymnasium. And I was always told that was the result of a bombing or something during the protests, but I had only ever heard of Sterling Hall, and I'm just wondering if anybody knew details about the Armory.
Yes, there was a bombing at the Armory as well. No one was injured. It was sort of a practice run. There were a couple of them before the bombing of Sterling Hall, but there was a minor bombing there first, as I remember it. I never call it the Armory. I always thought it was the Red Gym, but it's the same building I think you're talking about.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for calling in. Let's now go to Dave in La Crosse. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Just wanted to make the point. I was about 60 feet from the front door of the Commerce Building when this was all going down, and one person that I knew had gone in for an interview. And he was not kept from it. He said he had to step over some bodies. And this was, I don't know, I saw 20 or 30 protesters go in and they sat on the floor. But anyway, he had his interview and came out. And I knew another fellow who was in class at the time. And they were all chased out by the police, and he was instantly radicalized, and it was, he'd been a pretty conservative guy before that. So, I think the police charging into the buildings, ended up closing the campus for 4 days for nothing.
Mm. Dave, do you still think about this experience, and what goes through your mind today, 50 years later?
I think a lot of people consider, are quick to say that something is a riot when it didn't start that way. It started as a peaceful protest.
Yeah. David?
I would call it a police riot. I agree. It started as a peaceful protest, but the police went in with their clubs and bashed heads unforgivingly, and they were proud of it. The police who participated in that event later had a private secret club that they called the Dirty 30. Those were the police who bashed the heads that day.
And Dave in La Crosse is saying that the interview still went on with Dow Chemical.
Well, only a few did. Okay. Most of them were canceled, but there were a few interviews that had begun already and that did go on. And he's right that there were a lot of other classes being held in the Commerce Building that day, and most of those were interrupted, quote unquote, by what was going on.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for calling in with that remembrance. Let's go to John now in Nina. Hi, John.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I believe President Kennedy was murdered to get us into Vietnam, and for that reason, I believe his name belongs on the Vietnam Memorial in Washington.
Okay, a little deviation here from the actual Dow riot,
well,
but in greater context to the politics of the time.
There is still a great debate over what would have happened in Vietnam if President Kennedy had not been assassinated. There are historians who argue that he was on his way toward not going into Vietnam or removing the advisors, but he's the one who sent the advisors in the first place. It's not at all clear which way that would have gone. So, John has a perfect right to think what he wants. I don't know that there's many that would argue that he was assassinated for that reason.
Let's go to Catherine now in Stevens Point. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank
you. I just wanted to tell everybody I was in 11 o'clock zoology class on the basement of the Commerce Building that day, and I was a little girl off the farm, and as I'm coming up at 11:50, I think it was about the time the cops started storming the protesters, which were like maybe 20 people at the most, and we were tear gassed, and we were in the stairwell, and I had no idea what was going on, and I saw cops hitting people and beating them up, and by afternoon, I had gone to the Rathskeller and found out everything I could find out about Dow Chemical, the war, and I became political at that moment. Mm. But it was very scary, and I remember calling my parents and crying, saying, people don't do this in America, but they do, and they did, and they continued to do it. So the whole time I was in college, I was there working on campus the day they blew up Sterling Hall, and I knew it was going to happen.
Those comments strike me as fascinating, partly because they show the emotional response to an event and the disparity between what you think happened and what did happen. Unless you're down the other hallway where there were fewer people, there were hundreds of people in the hallway when the police went in. It wasn't 20 or 30. But there were two hallways going perpendicular from each other, and one hallway had fewer people in it. Maybe that's the one that you saw.
Yeah, go ahead, Catherine.
First floor. Oh, by the time I got to the first floor, it was chaos. Yeah. I mean, it was packed, shoving, hitting, and then from there on, it just, every year there was a different thing going on in Madison, and I became very political and started demonstrating against Dow Chemical.
And Bob, did you find your friends, your peers, getting more political as your years went on after the Dow riot?
Oh, definitely. All of my roommates and I, we started making signs. We were in the first marches all the way up State Street to the Capitol. There were a lot of people in that position that became, for whatever reason, instantly politicized and instantly became more activists to a different degree. There was certainly never, some people seem to want to paint it as a homogeneous group. There were people at various levels of protest and involvement, but I got very much involved, as did a number of friends of mine.
Catherine, thanks so much. Let's go to Chris now in Grafton. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning. First of all, thanks for the show. In 67, I was a five-year-old kid, and my dad was actually public relations director at Dow Chemical, and was on the other side of this event. And it was interesting in his retired years hearing him tell the story how furious they were from Dow with the way the police let the whole scene escalate and the way they had to be protected and evacuated out apparently a back door of the building. And it's just interesting, kind of the other side of the coin. And he knows, as one of your other comments were how there was quite a diverse group of opinions. Even within Dow, there's quite a group of diverse opinions about we got to do what the government says, make this product, we shouldn't do it. But his main thing was the way the police just let it turn into a beat down and a riot, kind of embarrassed them.
David?
Chris, I interviewed some of the old public relations people at Dow. I spent 2 days up in Midland, Michigan, going through all of their old documents. So I don't know if I interviewed your father or not, but it was the head of the public relations at Dow. And your comment is exactly right. They were sort of felt caught in the middle to some degree. Interestingly enough, the CEO of Dow at that time, his wife and son had turned against the war, and he was hearing it at home every night. So you're right. People tend to stereotype, but life is pretty complicated.
David, is it true that Dow saw this as a small, extraneous contract at first? And because I've read that, you know, this was just a minor contract. They didn't realize what they had gotten involved in.
Well, most
or
of their...
Or did they?
Well, I think they knew what they were getting involved in, but most of their profits came from Saran Wrap and other plastics, not from napalm and Agent Orange. So it wasn't, I would say in this case, even though they were profiting from it and had government contracts, they felt, from their perspective, they felt a patriotic duty to do what the Army asked them to do. Mm-hmm. And they certainly did it with some internal debate, but that's not to rationalize what they were doing, but that was their perspective on it.
Let's take Mike in Baraboo. Hi, Mike, go ahead.
Good morning. In the fall of 70, I was a student at a UW Extension campus in Baraboo, and when Sterling Hall got bombed, my father's first cousin, Jim Bull, was district attorney for Dane County. Subsequently, the same group that bombed Sterling Hall hired an airplane and with homemade bombs flew over the Badger Ordnance powder plant, which is about 8 miles from our home. Mm-hmm. Within a few days, everybody in the area was interviewed by the FBI, and hence a lot of our family gatherings when we go to Mr. Bull, with my father being a Battle of the Bulge veteran, we had some pretty interesting conversation.
Oh, David.
Well, there were, he's right that there was a, the Sterling Hall bombers had also tried to bomb the Baraboo munition works, or had with a fertilizer bomb of some sort. I'm not an expert on the 70s stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm more familiar with 1967, but yes, that was also part of that action.
Well, David, thank you so much for being here and remembering.
Well, it's something that I remember every year. October 17th and 18th, those 2 days reverberate with me every year.
David Marinus is an associate editor at the Washington Post, where he won a Pulitzer Prize in 1993. He wrote the book, They Marched Into Sunlight. And Bob Gruenberg, thank you so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Bob Gruenberg is a retired U.S. attorney who now lives in Dodge County, remembering the Dow riot. And by the way, oral history project going on at Madison Public Library's Central Library. Recording booths are set up at the library today and tomorrow for people sharing their memories of the Dow riot. This hour of the morning show was produced by Michelle Johnson, who also provided technical direction. Nyasia Ellison was our on-air producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation is on the Ideas Network.